Good afternoon. Today I'll be presenting on data collection on sexual orientation and gender identity within national health surveys for two English-speaking nations and making a comparison between the United States and the United Kingdom. And before I start, I just wanted to acknowledge my wonderful co-authors who are sitting here in the front, and I have no relationships to disclose. So as we all know, as the other speakers have mentioned, there are many health disparities when comparing the LGBT population to the general population, and these are some of the main health disparities that have been identified by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. So in the United States, the U.S. Healthy People objectives for the 2020 series, so they do new objectives every 10 years, they have added specific objectives related to LGBT health. So their goal is specifically to increase the number of population-based data systems used to monitor the HP 2020 objectives, which collect data on or for LGB and transgender populations. Have some context, so sexual orientation would include identity labels, so lesbian, gay, bisexual, and straight, for example, and then sexual behavior and attraction. So it's composed of those three things. And then gender identity may be defined as the fact that people can self-identify as any gender identity, including and beyond male-female descriptors. So the Healthy People 2020 objectives at baseline identified eight surveys in total that included any items related to sexual orientation. And then their goal is to increase that up to 12 data systems within their data collection system. They identified two surveys that collect any data on gender identity, and the goal is to increase that up to four. Over the next few years. And then the United Kingdom as well, like the United States, created some policy objectives that directly relate to LGBT health disparities. So that was done through the UK 2010 Equality Act, which incorporated an anti-discrimination clause on sexual orientation and what they call gender reassignment. And then the Office of National Statistics in the UK conducted a cross-sectional, a cross-government review of equality data and found that there was a dearth of data that addressed sexual orientation and gender identity. So therefore, they conducted several reliability and validity testing studies and decided to add a sexual identity question to the Integrated Household Survey in 2009. And that is a composite survey that includes several different modules and different surveys that collect data at a national level. So we've identified some existing gaps in the data systems that are used to collect sexual orientation and gender identity data to address these specific policy objectives around LGBT health disparities. So first of all, there is a lack, researchers have talked about the fact that there is a lack of uniform data collection on sexual orientation, both within the United States and between the United States and other countries internationally. And the other major gap is that there has been no previous focus on examining gender identity questions within national health surveys, both within the United States and in the United Kingdom. So there have been some studies that have compared sexual orientation items on national health surveys, but nothing has looked at gender identity specifically. And some research has also talked about the importance of collecting data on all three aspects of sexual orientation, and again, that would be identity, behavior, and attraction, because findings about health disparities might differ by the measurement of sexual orientation that is used. And I also just wanted to mention that there was a study in 2001 that looked at the sexual orientation items among the data collection systems for the Healthy People 2010 objectives, but now that gender identity is another aspect of these objectives for the 2020 objectives, we felt that an updated review was important. So, as I've mentioned, the objectives for this review were to address calls for uniform data collection to compare international sexual orientation data. We chose to focus just on the UK and the US data systems within the Healthy People 2020 objectives, as well as the UK 2010 Equality Act, because we felt that there, given that both countries were addressing LGBT health disparities through policies, we thought that a review and comparison was important. And again, as I mentioned, we wanted to provide an updated review of sexual orientation measurement methodology in conjunction with the HB 2020 objectives. So for the methods, we didn't do anything too complex, but we did a review of the most recent surveys related to sexual orientation and gender identity, both within the HP 2020 data systems and the UK survey, the IHS composite survey, to address the 2010 Equality Act. And we chose to focus only on the surveys that directly asked about sexual orientation and gender identity, although there were those that long list of surveys in the beginning that included any data collection on those items. We only wanted to focus on the ones that directly asked. And we then compared the sexual orientation and gender identity items by the question format to see if there was uniformity in the data collection method. Question placement within the survey, and that is because research has shown that question placement may affect participants' comfort level around answering sensitive questions related to sexual orientation, and it might also affect perceptions of confidentiality. So if the questions are included towards the beginning of the survey, that might make participants feel less comfortable. And then finally, we wanted to look at the method of data collection across the UK HP 2020 data systems and the IHS survey in the United Kingdom. And we included three coders for intercoder reliability. So these, as I had before, these are all of the surveys that collected any data on sexual orientation and gender identity. So there were the long list of surveys in the United States and the IHS composite survey in the UK. So in the U.S., as I mentioned, there were these five surveys that asked about sexual orientation directly, and the IHS survey as well asked about sexual orientation directly. Only the BRFSS and the HB 2020 data collection data system asked about gender identity directly, and we didn't find any in the U.K. that directly asked about this in terms of the U.K. 2010 Equality Act. So we did note that there were other surveys in the UK that were collecting data around sexual orientation and gender identity, but directly related to this policy, we only focused on the IHS. And I mentioned this already. And then in terms of sexual behavior, there were only three US surveys within the HP 2020 data systems that asked about sexual behavior, and only the NSFG asked about sexual attraction. Looking specifically at the identity questions, and I'll just highlight some of the some things here. There is clearly a variability in the question format that asks about identity. So the two that had the same exact question format were the NHANES and the NSFG. They asked, "Do you think of yourself as?" and "Do you?" And with these response options. And it seems that the NHANES confounds sexual identity labels with attraction, so making the assumption that if you identify as straight, for example, and you're a male, that you're only attracted to women, or if you are a gay-identified man, then you're only attracted to other men. But there are many nuances in sexual orientation that are not captured in that question. Not all of the surveys included the option of saying that you didn't know or you weren't sure. Some included them, but didn't read those responses to the participant, like the BRFSS didn't read those options. And the IHS survey asked the question slightly differently in the face-to-face format of their questionnaire versus the telephone. And again, in the IHS survey in the UK, don't know and refused were not provided as options to the respondents. Now looking at the behavior questions, and again, this is only on the U.S. surveys that we reviewed. So the NHANES, and just because there are many different types of questions that address sexual behavior in these surveys, we just are providing examples here from the female questionnaire and only those that ask about sex ever. So the NHANES survey asks, "Have you ever had any kind of sex?" and then it provides definitions of what that means, and it asks specifically about vaginal, oral, and anal sex. And then for female respondents, it asks, have you ever had any kind of sex with a woman? And again, defines what is meant by that. The NSFG has different question formats when it's face-to-face via the CAPI, and then on the ACASI, which is self-report. And here, they did not define what is meant by sexual experience of any kind with another female. So with the NHANES, they do have that definition. And then in the YRBS, this was just a much more general question without any specifics. And then with the attraction question, again, there was only the one survey, the NSFG, that asked about that at all. And while it's great that the question was included, we noted here that it only asks about attraction within the gender binary, so just males and females, but no nuances there. Finally, looking at the gender identity questions, we noted that the BRFSS was the only U.S. survey within the HP 2020 data systems that asked directly about gender identity and asking, do you consider yourself to be transgender, but then only asking more specifically about gender nonconforming identity if the person identifies as transgender. So the person respondents were not given the opportunity to provide nuances there unless they responded yes to that initial question about transgender identity. So this is just a summary here of the placement within the surveys of where these questions about orientation and identity were included. So because there's a lot of text there, just to summarize that for all of the surveys, these questions were included towards the end, which we found to be, based on the research, is more effective in collecting data around sexual orientation and gender identity. And that was true for both the UK and the US. And then there was also a variability in the method of data collection. So some were done by telephone, some self-report via ACASI, some included both ACASI and face-to-face data collection, for example, like in the UK survey and the NSFG in the United States. So in conclusion, after reviewing all of the questions, we found that there is a need for surveys addressing all three aspects of sexual orientation, because research has shown that findings do vary by measurement and that there are nuances in sexual orientation. We also noted that there is a clear need for standardization across surveys, both within the U.S. surveys and the HP 2020 data collection systems and between the U.S. and the U.K. And then there is a need for surveys that address gender identity directly and probably the nuances within gender identity as well. So for future directions, because this was just a review of the question formats and the research methodology, it would be important to do more comparisons between different countries that collect similar data to address LGBT discrimination and health disparities. And then for my own research, I'm also planning to analyze health disparities by these different measurements of sexual orientation, including identity, behavior, and attraction, using the National Survey for Family Growth, since that includes all three items. Thank you very much.
So I was just given a little tip that I have to have one of the slide presentations open to record. I'm not sure about that, but we're just going to leave this up in case that's the case. And I just want to open it up for questions. We have about 20 minutes for Q&A, and these were fantastic presentations, thought-provoking, so I'm sure everyone has things to ask our presenters. Would anyone like to start? So.
Yeah, great presentation, and I can start with I have a question about, you said that some of the respondents thought, and I wanted to know, did you actually ask if they identified, if you were characterizing
I asked, how would you describe your identity? And some of them, would first bring up, I identified soft butch, I identified stone butch, and then later during the interview would sort of describe themselves as more of a lesbian. And so in terms of like kind of creating categories, I would really more categorize them both like as vulnerable links. Like I kept that data in there, but I didn't offer options of what they could or could not identify as. And most of them would check in and would be like, I identify as soft glitch, is that what you mean? And I would say, well, it's more about how you identify, but in order to kind of create sort of some kind of analysis across categories, it's such a small sample, really not really possible in this case, but I try to include that information just to sort of say that, like, this is more likely to be found than lesbian identified participants.
They would.
Just like such a, like, if I had a finding, to be a finding, to be able to say that this is more likely to be found.
Because you said they were speaking Hindi, right?
Most of them were speaking English, but they would go back and in and out.
So they would use the terms like soft switch
in English.
Okay. Yeah, because I know that like there's been research on Hong Kong and Thailand, and like some Euro-Western researchers have characterized them as lesbians. Some have characterized them as trans men. And I know that in some of the research, I don't know how the research has been, but when they've been told that they're lesbian, some of them have had a violent reaction to being characterized that way. So I'm just curious.
Yeah, which is part of my sort of intention in trying to keep people who identify as unlabeled to talk about labels. And but again, they would, most of it was those identity labels were in English, unfortunately.
Right.
So when
you're
thinking
about
any other questions? Yeah.
I have a question for the presentation about men in North China. You had a slide that said the percentage of, I guess, HIV and what you attributed to, like there was the red bar that was for homosexual men, there was other for heterosexual. That interested me. Is that how they identified, or is that people that said, yeah, it's a homosexual man? How is that attributed? Because I feel like there's a bit of data quality issues about that breakdown.
Right. No, those labels were completely decided upon by the public health, the national public health department. Was that term, homosexual, yeah. Most of the folks did, and this is information that I was able to glean while I was doing just a qualitative interview. So there are different kinds of self-labeled identities. There was Pengzi, which is kind of the equivalent of gay for North America. And then other folks would just say, I am. Kind of just implicitly. Some folks would say just outright, they just, okay, yes, I am, what translating to homosexual. But that, for that particular line that you're referring to, that was just imposed by the public health.
Yeah.
You said at one point, you were reading a quote and you said, and you were saying, so I still have two girlfriends.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering whether, because the person you're talking about is a person who has sex with men and women, or a person who feels like socially it's important to have girlfriends to sort of buoy a sort of social capital type of piece.
Well, I thought it was interesting when the speaker was talking about the pressure to get married, and that's also very common in a lot of West Africa, a lot of low and middle income countries. But so I think it's kind of a mixture of both. I don't know the particular individual's story, but I'm guessing that it's something kind of between where they probably do have girlfriends, but there's also a lot of social pressure, and probably pressure to get married, and that might kind of help to stop off some of that pressure. You know.
Just to follow up though on your question about those labels, you know, in Chinese there's not a distinction between really sex and gender that's widely, there's no consensus on this distinction. So some folks have been trying to introduce this new term, gender, like a direct transliteration for gender, making a distinction there, but for the general, most folks, there's not that distinction there. It's like male.
Yeah.
I actually have a comment for Jonathan. I wanted to say two things. First of all, I thought some fantastic use of the socio-ecological model. My public health students that I teach at Cleveland State University can learn a lot from you. And the second comment I wanted to make was thank you so much for being so explicit about the use of CBTR. I feel that especially with LGBT research, both in this country and abroad, the that's a methodology that I think we can use probably more effectively than we are now. I personally am very invested in community-based research. I feel very strongly that they need to be involved with that process from start to finish. So again, I'm really glad that you took the time, because it is a time-consuming methodology, to involve these women in that process.
Thank you so much.
There was a comment back here. Yeah.
I guess this is a question that can be answered by some people at the research institution of Boston and Northern China. But I was wondering how visibility of an LGBT person is mediated by the local cultures or by their ties with the rest of the community.
Could you say that? One more time?
I was just wondering if how important visibility as an LGBT person was to the person and how that would be given by the local community or like their time for the community.
So I actually have a little piece about that. So participants find that most of them in precarious situations, they're high in their MSM identity, and homosexuality is considered, quote, taboo against nature, deviation, abomination, a curse. So that's some of the things we got from some of the quotes from the participants in the study.
So I think, like, when I think of, like, visibility, I think of, like, things that would be almost like a visual flag, right? Like, where you just walk and sort of see that someone might be trying to cue themselves into a certain community. And I think that, for me, I like, just as sort of, like, my own personal, like, future directions, I would love to look at that a little bit more with sexual minority women, because they talked about that, of like being on the train, and trains are a big part of Mumbai, but like being on the train and like checking out other women and being like, you know, like they can tell like that they might be queuing into sort of a more of a, usually again it's a sort of a butch identity that flags them. But for a lot of the women, being a part of the community and being a spokesperson in that community was a really big part of if they were able to do it, that it was a big part of their lives, it was important for them, it was an important part of their identity. But it was not, it was either a really big part of your life or not at all. You couldn't necessarily like keep your side job. Like it was like, you did it and you did it. Because it had so many ramifications that you had to go all in. So that question, I think, is such an interesting one. So I appreciate you bringing that up.
Jasmine, I wanted to follow up on that. So it's interesting that some of the folks had no labels, but then you also talked about community connectedness. And I wonder if you saw, and perhaps I missed it, but a differentiation between people that identified with a lesbian or bisexual or any of the labels that you found, and the no labels and community connectedness. Because I'm wondering if you're a part of the community, how I feel like labels would come stronger with community identification. So I'm wondering what you saw on that.
Yeah, so what I see from it is a lot of times people would initially, and so this is kind of going back to your question, people would initially identify as not wanting a label, mm-hmm. and then through the interview would take a lesbian label, like it would be like, I guess you could call me a lesbian. And I think that sometimes in their community interactions, that was sort of seen where other people would, because I would hang out with them quite a bit, and so they would know those people as a lesbian. And they would be like, well, she's bi, isn't she? But so other people would put labels on them, and sometimes they would use labels to kind of interact with the group. But I don't think it necessarily, you couldn't say that they were either a part of the group or not part of the group based on whether or not they were taking a label.
Mm-hmm.
This is, if you sort of got along with those people, because it's Mumbai and it's a very social, clicky kind of vibe sometimes, and so if you got along with those people, then they were your people.
Mm-hmm.
Not based on label or otherwise, it was just sort of like if you opted in.
Steve, did you want to comment on the question about visibility in China?
I think some of it really differed by religious affiliation, especially among the folks who identified as Muslim. There is this very vibrant and growing sexual minority community in North China and Beijing and Tianjin. But for folks who identified as Muslim, there was a distance between they didn't really want to be part of this growing community. Among some of the Christian folks, the same as well. But what was interesting is that there are more sexual minority Christian groups popping up in some of the major cities in China. So that was where they found that they had the most in common, other folks who share their sexual orientation and their religious belief systems as well. That was provided as a very strong source of support. As far as queues go, like just walk on the trains or on the buses or so, most folks did not have an intention to make visual queues overall on the whole, though.
Great. Leanne, did you have any thoughts on visibility amongst the asylum seekers that you were reporting on?
I don't know if I actually answered the question very well. So are we referring to visibility in terms of how they would interact with each other?
Well, I'll refer that back to the question asker.
I don't know, because my population are very isolated, and mm-hmm. so it's hard for me to answer that question, because we're working on getting that community together, and there's just not that much of that going on.
Thanks.
I have a question in terms of the Chinese context. I've heard that in India that there's some sort of religious life where people are considering about circumcision, and if someone is sort of a certain religion, that they would be circumcised, therefore they might be cleaner, therefore they might, that would in, like, influence their economy or not economy. Are you seeing these sort of things in China?
Regarding circumcision?
Well, I mean,
or
that's the lines of
practices.
Yeah, I guess, I mean, like, for along India, it's sort of like whether or not there's going to be stigma or not? I didn't mean to take us into like a deep dark tunnel there. Whether or not, like penis is considered sort of clean, and so if not, then they might be more likely to use the condom. So that's how it kind of ends up in India. But I don't know if that's the same,
right,
or if there are different considerations along the religion.
The prevalence of circumcision was much higher among the Muslim folks, but it was still fairly low, about 15%. I think 30%. But there was one fellow who I interviewed, and he was saying he would refuse to give oral to someone else because he felt that the mouth was for praising God, praising Allah, for eating, and that found the penis to be dirty. He would not do that. So these ideas of these religious ideas did influence people's willingness to engage in certain types of behavior, for sure. Going back real quickly to visibility, though, I was thinking, there's probably a distinction between, this everyday walking around in public visibility and then for the online world. Most of the folks did have like an online different profiles, and within that there was another kind of an online visibility that may not have been the same as walking around in public.
And of course, it's also night. The nighttime was a different time when people felt freer to kind of go out, go to bars, and travel, and so on. They might not feel the same way during the day, especially more feminine and MSM.
That's a better way of raising the question: how important is it to visibility? I guess a better way to phrase my question was how important visibility was depending on the context.
Also, I saw another question, a person in a white shirt. You had raised your hand a moment ago. Did you want
to
get your...
Maybe what you were asking wasn't what I was thinking also, but
trying to say is there's association with unprotected sex and circumcision.
And I was wondering if there was an association of that along with religious one.
Right. And I'm just wondering,
I don't think it is. Oh, so you're asking if there was an association between circumcision and unprotected sex.
No, based on sort of religion lines.
We didn't look at circumcision and unprotected sex. So, no, I guess.
I had a question for Margaret. The questionnaires that you used were some of the big data that Healthy People has endorsed or has recognized. But we know that there's a lot of smaller research projects, maybe many of us are involved in things smaller than NHANES and the ones that you explored. This is outside of your study, which was great, but what have you seen in these smaller studies in terms of the way people are asking questions and trends are getting set around question asking outside of big data?
I mean, I'm not sure that I have a...
I know, it's a little unfair of a question, but I...
I guess just anecdotally in the projects that I've been involved in, it seems like it follows the trends of the larger surveys. Because a lot of those have been validated, which I guess is interesting because they may be validated with the freezing barriers. But yeah, that's a great question, and I would be interested to know more, but I don't think I have a definite answer.
Fair enough, yeah.
Can I ask a sort of follow-up question to that?
Sure.
There's a version of Berger's which is for youth, is that right? It's a behavioral risk factor.
Oh, the YRBS?
Yeah. Do you know if that one asks similar questions about sexual orientation and identity?
Yeah, I think I have that one there.
Okay.
So I believe it asks the same type of question.
Okay.
Yeah, the YRBS says ask which of the following best describes you.
For sexual orientation or gender identity.
For identity.
Oh, great, okay. Mm-hmm. So, you know, just a general question, it seems like a trend now is like global health, right?
Sure.
And it's really great. I mean, I really acknowledge all of you. I think it's a very cutting edge panel and session. And like, so what, do you have any last minute tips, parting words on like, how can we really create a space within like schools and programs and colleges of public health, you know, to have an active LGBT research agenda, especially when that's beyond MSM HIV research.
Well, mine is MSM HIV research, so.
I think one of the things, and this is just like, this is a huge, I have lots of questions, right? Like, you could devote a whole career to this. But one of the things that is about sort of asking those community partners, like if a university already has a community partner abroad, then either do they do work with other populations or in other areas perhaps, even still less than at MSM, but maybe are there other areas that they think are interesting, or do they know of other community partners that are in their same sort of domains that might be strong, and I think going to the local context would be a really strong way to let that be.
I think just following up on that, I had done some work during my social work program in the Dominican Republic, and it was around HIV and some health with a local organization there, and the reason why I was able to work with them is because they had connections with the university there, who had connections with my university in the U.S., so I think definitely having some kind of relationship between
nothing wrong with MSM HIV research,
I
just want to say, but like to maybe augment from that.
Well, I can say too, HIV program targeting MSM can lead into other projects.
Yeah.
This project, research prevention, is a very large project by USAID, and so we were asking a lot of human rights questions, violence questions, and so on that really are, I mean, they're related to HIV, but it was kind of going off into more sociological research.
Right.
I just want to put in a quick plug. The LGBT Caucus is holding a social event tonight. We're going bowling at Lucky Strike at 7:30. We'd love to see all of you out there on the bowling lanes. We encourage you to stay involved with the caucus. Membership, student membership is only $10, and it's a great way to spend your $10. And I believe that grown-up post-student membership is 45, so it's affordable, and we would love your support. We'd love to have you join us Any other announcements from LGBT conscious folks?
We also have the we also give out an annual Walter Lear Award for student best student abstract. So if you're a student or if you know students, please let them know. And it's a $500 award. And the bowling tonight, I think it's going to go till about 10. So if you can't make it at 7, you want to hit other socials, then you can come later and we'll be there.
Great. One more round of applause for our great presenters.